It is Locked On Jazz on the 29th of May. Happy birthday, Dad. I'm back with you. We're rolling. Joe Ingles, season in review. The NBA Finals for a fourth straight time. And a Time Machine Tuesday. It's all coming up on today's edition of Locked On Jazz. Pow! How are you, David Locke, radio voice of the Utah Jazz, Jazz NBA insider. Glad to be back with you on Locked On Jazz. Thank you very much. I took the week last week and went back east with my son to visit colleges a little early in the process since he's only a sophomore, but I would credit him. It was one of the most enjoyable weeks of my life just to watch him take it very seriously and take it very intellectually and very mature. It was fun. Great. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful part of our country. If you, we were up in Boston and Vermont and Maine and New Hampshire. Really, that was just great weather, beautiful part of our country. So enjoyed it. Love the area around Burlington and Portland, Maine are two absolutely beautiful gems if you're looking for some place to go. All right, let's get back at it. Joe Ingles breakdown, NBA Finals outlooks, and Time Machine Tuesday all coming your direction. Today's show is brought to you by Murdoch Hyundai as well as Grip 6 Belts. Joe Ingles is really one of the great stories of the league. And when you look at his evolution as a player and what he's done, it's wow material. A large part of the last 2 years comes to his ability to do two things. One is to hit the above the break three, and two is to hit the three off the bounce. When he started in the league, he was a 36% three-point shooter. Year two, he was 37. The last 2 years, he's 44% three-point shooter for his last. And we talk about 750 being the key number for his last 743s. He's a 44% shooter. That is legit. It's an incredible, incredible story. I'm only talking about him on the court here. The intangibles, the 82 games played consecutively, both the last two seasons, the 81 the year before, the jumping from 15 minutes to 24 minutes to 31 minutes in the last three seasons. It's his effective field goal percentage this year was 61%. I mean, I really view him as a playmaking Kyle Korver, and I think Kyle Korver is one of the most important players in this league. And I'll be honest, when he was a free agent a year ago, my viewpoint on Joe was largely that he was a Quinn Snyder system player. And I still believe this to some extent and still have some debates that exist for me when it comes to Joe, like as we start playing around all offseason and try to find, you know, that next player that adds to who we are, is the bona fide scorer, changes us, moves us to the next level. All those things, you know, you have a tendency, well, will Joe come off the bench? And I you know, he's a pretty darn good player, right? I mean, 12 points, 4 rebounds, and 5 assists is probably not exactly what you want out of that. In the playoffs, you know, how good was he? You know, he still shot his 46% from 3. It felt like in the second series he was not quite as valuable, but that's hard to say. Those are, you know, you'd have to really probably dig into the and watch the video a little bit. But he was he becomes incredibly valuable the minute Ricky Rubio's out because he's a ball handler. So, I mean, he's really one of the great stories of the league and how he's evolved. And then there, I still, you know, the numbers tell me not to doubt him at all, not to get caught up in the visual. Can that really be one of your key pieces? And I'm not sure I think he's your, like, number two key piece offensively, but he's pretty vital. And he's Kyle Korver, and when we dig into his pick-and-roll stuff, when you look at what he did, he was, this last year, corner three shooting is 53%, which is insane. But if you look at his shooting over the years, he went from 36 to 39 to 44 to 44, without a huge jump in his corner three. It was his above-the-break three-point shooting that changed. And then secondarily, it was his off-the-bounce three-point shooting. That little step back behind the pick that he and Zach Guthrie worked on so much. that as much as anything is what kind of changed him. And even in the playoffs, he was able to do it. He hit 38% off the bounce. He hit 38% for the regular season, 46% catch and shoot. You leave him open for three, he's going to murder you. He's and that's what we're talking about. He's not Kyle Korver coming off the picks to come get it. But if you leave him open, if you look at his numbers on unguarded catch and shoot, he is a 73% effective field goal percentage. Other than about Otto Porter and maybe one or two Steph Curry, maybe Kyle Korver, there just are not many better than Joe. And even on a guarded catch and shoot, he's begun to add that to his game a tiny bit. He's in the ninth 66th percentile. Looking at him overall, spot-up shooter, he's in the 80th percentile in the league. Off the screen, he's in the 86th. Transition, he was actually pretty good. And if he can just get a shot. Now, pick and roll, there's two sides to his story. One is a 28% turnover rate. And the one question I do have, and he's such a great ball handler, he's done such a great job in the pick and roll. His pick and roll percentage was tied with Rubio for best on the team. He was with Favors at 9.55 and Gobert at 9.35 points per were some of the best. I think the 9.55 with Favors was our best pick and roll combination on the team. There was a uniqueness to what the Jazz did in that Rubio ran 2,400 pick and rolls. Donovan ran about 2,400 and Joe could run 1,400. And you could come at teams from different directions and Joe allowed you to do that. The question as we move forward and try to take the next step is still, to me, a little bit of a question on how much of Joe is unique to Joe, how much of Joe is unique to what Quinn has built in a system that runs more pick and rolls, more handoffs than anyone else, and that Joe fits it or that a lot of players would fit it. I just don't know the answer. And what I mean by that is trying to just figure out if you put somebody else in that spot, Hayward was there the year before, and Randall, would you have the same productivity or is it unique to what Joe has been able to do with his skill set? And that honestly, I think is a huge decision for the front office, and I don't know the answer of how much, you know, if you look at Joe in 82 games and he's using, you know, if he ran 1,400 pick and rolls over the season, that's a slight. It was actually, you know, I'm rounding up nicely, but so of the, you know, 17 pick and rolls he's running a game of those, is he better than other guys at that? If somebody else, were to have those 17 pick and rolls, would they be as good as Joe or not? Is particularly at that position? I think it's interesting. Synergy has Joe as just the 36th percentile on pick and roll play because of his 28% turnover rate as the ball handler. Now, they aren't giving him probably enough credit for all of his passes out the way they do things. In a day and age where switching has become a big deal and you need isolations, Joe only ran 49 isolations all year. He's pretty darn good at it. He was fine, right? Like, he's not bad at it, but he only ran 49. We don't run a lot of isolation. But as time continues and you have to run more isolation, I think he was actually pretty good in the playoffs in isolation. I think it's a really interesting discussion because our heart and mind loves the guy. He's one of the great stories of the league. His improvement level is just awesome. His personality is the core of the team. His shooting is Kyle Korver elite. And I hope people understand, like, when I'm talking about a guy being Kyle Korver level, I mean, I that's as big a compliment as I can get. I think Kyle Korver's game-changing. He's one of our best pack players. So there's a lot of things here where he's great. The question is, can he be great with somebody else taking a bunch of those possessions? Can he be, you know, I think that's I don't know the answer to this. I really don't. Or is he that vital? His secondary ball handling is incredibly important to this team. However, like, isolation in the playoffs, I just looked it up. He had 31. He averaged 0.67 points per isolation. Like, that's not great. And as the league gets into more switching and it's more beating people off the bounce later in the playoff series, and as the that's not going to be a strength of Joe's. Catch and shoot. Play the pick and roll, find some guys. He's not, there's an interesting little note on him that guys are not shooting a great percentage off of passes from him last year. I don't know why that is, actually. I could probably try to figure it out a little bit. I think some of his lack of athleticism means it's harder for him to find some passing windows. But again, our best pick and roll combination just with two guys is him and Fu. He's terrific. And what he's done to evolve is just incredible. And as we try to look at him and the team moving forward, it's interesting the small forward position comes up or other players come up. And then, so what's Joe's role? And then what does Joe's role need to be? I find that to be a really interesting discussion point for the franchise. And I hope it doesn't get taken in any way as a criticism to Joe. But if at some point, you know, it's always the way I felt about Rodney Hood. If Rodney Hood was our starting two, he was average to below average as a starting two. And if he was our sixth man, he might be one of the better six men off the bench. And so if we were going to be a great team, he probably was a sixth man. Is there a level with Joe where something of the sort is true as well? That if he's your starting small forward and your second or third offensive option, that's not good enough. But if he's the leader of your second unit with all of his versatile skills and then late in games playing off your primary guys with his incredible shooting, that is good enough. That's probably where I'm leaning. Just a thought. You know, we'll see. Funny experience. I got a text yesterday from Blake Murdoch of Murdoch Hyundai. And he was like, hey, great news. Time for you to trade cars. And I was like, oh. And that gave me a pretty good idea of how much I like the Kona. So I'm driving the Kona now, which is the new Hyundai small SUV. So kind of the compete with the Subaru Sport Track or whatever it's called. And I've really found myself kind of loving it. It's got 30. I just filled up on the way home today. It's got 30 miles to the gallon. It's zippy and gets up and down the canyon great. It doesn't have a lot of space. That's not what it's made for. I mean, plenty of space if you're seating. But if we're putting in the golf clubs and things, it's always easier to have a seat down than try to force it in. But it's a fabulous car. So check it out. I evidently am giving mine back. Maybe you can get the one I've been driving. I love it. It's 4646 South State Street. It's Murdoch Hyundai. When you're dealing with the Murdochs, of course, you're getting the 100,000-mile Hyundai Assurance. You're also getting the Murdoch Guarantee, which is car washes, safety inspection, price match guarantee, all the experiences that they can control for you. It's the no-regrets buying experience at Murdoch at 4646 South State Street. Go check out that Kona. All right, the NBA Finals are set again. Let me go with a few things. So we get this now conclusion. The chapter is closed. The book is finished. And now we do this post-analysis. I have a hard time doing a post-analysis on a game in which someone missed 25 straight threes and was missing a key cog. Now, I think I have less sympathy on missing the key cog of Chris Paul than some other people because of the fact that I think we knew that that was a risk, right? He's missed 20% of his games over the last few years. So it's a legitimate risk that he's going to end up being hurt and then it happens in the playoffs. I don't have a great deal of sympathy. Like, I think that's part of roster building and that's what happened. But the Warriors didn't look right to me that whole series. I thought they looked exposed. What they were exposed, I didn't know. I kept starting to write the tweet. I actually took notes during the game, which I never published. And I said at one point in the game, I wrote, the Warriors look defeated. They look broken. All series, it felt like the Rockets have exposed them. I'm not sure how or what has been exposed, but they have not had the zest other than brief explosions, and there's been nothing consistent to the Warriors. And I actually think, as I thought about this more, trying to figure that out. So the Rockets blew up entirely how the Warriors play. Their off-ball screen game was not nearly as potent as it was. It forced him into isolation. It got Durant, the worst part of Durant, just going one-on-one all the time and seemingly ignoring teammates. They absolutely knocked the Warriors out of who the Warriors were, and they didn't look right, and they exposed them on the offensive glass in the game, in Game 7, and yet the Warriors still won. Klay Thompson's a bad isolation player, and they forced him into about 50 isolations over that series, maybe a little less. But they did everything that you could do to the Warriors and discombobulated them, and yet they're still so loaded with so much talent, and Steph Curry's so great that they won the series. And do they win that series with Chris Paul? Do the Rockets win the series with Chris Paul? I don't know. But that's my takeaway after kind of digested for 12 hours or whatever, a little less, is that, yeah, the Warriors never looked right to me, and they did look defeated, and they did look frustrated because the Rockets were good enough to do that to them, and yet the Warriors still were able to overcome that. Now, remember, in the KD era, the Warriors had lost 3 games in the playoffs the entire time, and they lost 3 in the series, which is an incredible statement of what the Rockets were doing. Is there something to both the Rockets and the Celtics missing all these Game 7 shots that you're shooting from 25 feet if you're a little tight and you're making diamonds out of your backside? Are you suddenly going to be a little tighter and have a harder time making these shots than you would otherwise? Maybe. I'm going to go, and I think anytime a team misses 25 straight threes and has the night that the Rockets had, I'm going to go with a confluence of events that has taken place. I think one I always talk about is the physically superior. So Trevor Ariza is guarding Kevin Durant, and Kevin Durant is physically superior. Eric Gordon is dealing with Steph Curry. I think Steph Curry is probably physically, athletically superior. James Harden and Klay Thompson's a pretty good matchup, but I think Klay Thompson might be, you're dealing, Draymond Green is more physical than whomever he was, and they're switching so much. But for the most part in that series, the Warriors had an athletic, physical advantage, and I think that partially wore the Rockets down. I think the 30 minutes a night of Chris Paul missing was huge, and that wore the Rockets down. The travel schedule is brutal late in these series. No one talks about it, but you're playing every other day in different cities. Excuse me. You're playing Game 4 in Houston, or Game 4 in Oakland, Game 5 in Houston, Game 6 in Oakland, Game 7 in Houston. Like, the travel schedule is brutal. So you're playing high motion, physically grueling, physically overmatched. I think that's the same case in some cases with Boston. I think Boston was physically overmatching Cleveland for much of that series. And your travel, and I think that suddenly you go 7 of 44 from 3. By the way, the Rockets went 7 of 44 from 3. A historically worst shooting three-point night with 25 straight misses. Their offensive rating was a 102 last night. They hit 3 of those, go 10 of 44, score an extra 9 points. Their offensive, not only do they possibly win, their offensive rating is a 112, which would be great. They actually had, the Warriors didn't have this great offensive game last night. In many ways, the Rockets, now the 17 offensive rebounds the Rockets got were a huge part of that. And boy, was Kevin Durant just awful in the first half. But I think that, my takeaway on the three-point shooting is I think it's a confluence of events. I think the Warriors defend well. I think the Rockets were fatiguing. I think the injury to Chris Paul meant their minutes were going. I think they played a lot of minutes and not a lot of guys. And I think they're physically outmatched, and so their bodies were wearing down. They started to miss. And then I think they get tight. And there's no question that shooting from 25 feet over 4 feet makes a big difference when there's a lot on the line. I'm not willing to go that this is some indictment of the way the Rockets play or what the Rockets did. I might even go the other way. I thought the Rockets represented themselves pretty well in the series. And I think that part of me looks at the Warriors right now and thinks to myself, boy, they look more vulnerable. The Jazz are closer than I thought. I don't know if that's true. I think that might be that the Rockets were good enough to, as I said, discombobulate the Warriors, make them look defeated, make them look broken, make them look exposed, because the Rockets were that good. And that, and I'm not sure the Warriors would have looked that way against the Jazz, or that the, and I don't think the Rockets looked that way against the Jazz, frankly. I thought the Jazz blew up what the Rockets were doing, but the Rockets were so good that they were able to handle it. So that's my take on that series. There's also a level just, you know, Steph's incredible, right? Steph's incredible, and Durant gives them, I thought Durant was really awful until this in the first half of the game. I didn't know what was going on. And the Warriors do have some flaws, right? So Draymond Green can't shoot right now. And then they only had 3-pointers made by Durant, Curry, and Thompson, other than one by Nick Young. So their shooting is not nearly the way they hoped the roster had built when they added Omri Caspi and a bunch of these other guys. And Andrew Iguodala is not shooting it as well either. So there's definitely a level where this is considerably different than they envisioned it would be. Yet they're still, you know, going back to their fourth championship. By the way, Rockets got better shots than the Warriors last night. The Rockets qualified shot quality last night was 54%, the 53.8, and the Warriors was 51.5, and the Warriors shot 7 percentage points better, and the Rockets shot 10 percentage points, probably their worst night of the year. And that's not just that, you know, I got the Kevin Pelton luck concept. I'm not going with luck on this one. I'm going that they were worn out in the process. Cleveland, LeBron's the greatest player of our generation and one of the greatest players of all time. That performance was amazing. The third quarter to me was the most amazing, when he came out and just distributed and got everyone else going. The narrative that people are floating around, because Rodney Hood's not good and George Hill's not good, so somehow, but that's actually not true. George Hill and Rodney Hood's numbers are actually close to where they were for their career. The idea that somehow people are talking about that, look, you players don't play as well with LeBron, I'm not buying this narrative at all, particularly if you look through his entire career. Jeff Green's having an incredible series. The guys we, J.R. Smith's career is much better with LeBron than anyone else. The guys we know, we think are not as good. But George Hill had a career year last year, which led to largely who he was. And if you look at his career, this year's right back to it a little bit. And, you know, there's a chance that Rodney Hood's not that good. And there's a chance that Rodney Hood's not that good on a great team. And that his situation, they don't need him. And so they're not dealing with it. Whereas the Jazz massaged it beautifully. I mean, I think Rodney's better than not playing, but maybe not. So I'm not buying that narrative on the idea that somehow, some way, LeBron doesn't make his teammates better. Is he hard to play with? I guess. He's also carried a million straight teams to the NBA Finals, so I'm probably not really going there either. Today's show is brought to you in part by Grip 6 Belts. Golf season is here. Grip 6 has got some cool things on the golf end of things. They don't intend it for this. But so Grip 6 is the really, really cool part because of two things. One, so they have the belt that doesn't have holes and it then is flapless. So you flip it in and it locks right behind and holds securely wherever you want. If your waist changes a little bit like mine does throughout the season, you just adjust it. They're manufactured right in Salt Lake City. 100% of the materials are sourced from the U.S. Hands-on manufacturing. They do not wear out. They're just awesome product. And then they've got what I think from golf standpoint is really kind of cool with Grip 6 is if you look at it, you can go buy – the belt buckles are interchangeable. So you can buy whatever color you want your web strapping to be and then buy a bunch of the other classic buckles and use those and change them out depending what you want, which is kind of a golf thing to do. Like, you could have been wearing your USA flag ones on Memorial Day. They've got great selection. It's at grip6.com. Use the promo code LOCKED. I got these belts from Keenan, and I have worn them ever since. And I gave them to my dad. He's worn them ever since. I have given them to our scouts as thank yous. They have worn them ever since. Once you do the Grip 6, you will love them. They also got a women's line and a kids line if you want to check it out. Grip6.com, promo code LOCKED, gets you 25% or 20% off. Time Machine Tuesday. Let's go to the 1995-96 season, the year before the NBA Finals run. We go to May 29th. This is always, this is my dad's birthday today, 79. I used to always take my dad and give my dad as a present for his birthday during this time period. I would fly him out or bring him here and get him tickets, usually in the upper bowl somewhere high because I didn't have a lot of pull. Tickets to a game. So this is one of those series where we did that. But May 28th, we would be riding high that the Jazz had just, this is one of the great days of Jazz franchise history, actually. The Jazz had just gone to Seattle, trailing 3-1 in the Western Conference Finals, went to Seattle on May 28th, and won in overtime, 98-95, just a bloodbath of a second half. The Seattle went up 9 in the first. Jazz fired back with great grit in the second to take a 3-point lead at the half. They were tied going to the fourth, and the fourth quarter of that game was 19-all. The pace on this game was an 82-possession game. The offenses were just pounding each other. Mailman had 29 points despite 7 of 13 at the free throw line. That series was not a good one. Hornacek came up huge for the Jazz, had 27. John Stockton in 38 minutes of game 5 was 1 of 6 from the field with 6 assists is all for the whole game. Jerry started Chris Morris and Felton Spencer and played Brian Russell and Anquan Carr pretty much the whole night. Mailman played 49 as they went to OT. Hornacek had 46, played 46. Brian Russell had 45 minutes. Carr had 40. Stockton, 38. And I mean, this was just, everyone was tight, battling, kind of ugly, fighting through it along the way. The Sonics, Sean Kemp had 24, 13, and 5. Gary Payton just had a monster night. 31 points, 5 rebounds, 6 assists. You know what the narrative was. Payton had 31, 5, and 6, and Stockton had 4, 4, and 6. Detlef Schrempf had played 45. Hersey Hawkins played 12, or had scored 12. Sam Perkins was out there making it too hard to play Felton Spencer. Sonics took 18 threes. Jazz took 13. Jazz took 40 free throws to the Supersonics, 24, and were able to pull off the win and go to a game 6, which would be tomorrow, the May 30th, back in Salt Lake City, obviously eventually forcing the game 7. But what a game 5 of the Western Conference Finals in 1996 between the Jazz and the Supersonics is just a great game. I mean, it's one of those all-time slugfest games. Jazz gutted it out late to get it and pull it off. There's a write-up I found on the greatest conference finals of all time, and this one was one of them. In game 7, went 7. We've seen kind of what a game 7 was the other day, and the Jazz forcing it through this win was certainly one of those, in that the Jazz were able to force that game and then win in Seattle, which at the time was, you know, Key Arena was rocking and one of the most difficult places for anyone to play. So very one of the better wins in Jazz history as they outscored them 8-5 in that overtime and pulled off the win. So that is our Time Machine Tuesday today, kind of a fun one to go back and look at. And the Jazz came back, won game six, forced game seven, and now and then obviously the next 2 years were able to break through that loss. That loss was just crushing in Seattle in game seven with the free throws and all of that. But what an incredible, fun one to remember. And obviously a great matchup between those guys. All right, that wraps us up. Have a great one. Thanks for tuning in. The Kona over at Murdoch Hyundai, grip6.com. Use the promo code LOCKED. Look forward to talking with you today. It was fun to talk with you today. We'll be back with you. Plan for the rest of the week. I'm going to look at some research projects I'm working on. I'll start to watch draft guys. We'll continue our season previews, reviews of players as well. Talk to you soon. Thanks. Bye.